The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Welcome to Discover Extra Edition. Stories from Discover, the magazine of science, that we didn't have time for in our regular monthly podcast. I'm your host, Steve Lord, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Episode number 10 of Discover Extra Edition contains 7 stories covering insulin, obesity, war-scarred forest, big cats, building blocks, third parties in transactions, and reviving ancient plants and viruses. The insulin hypothesis is not so sweet. Researchers supporting what's called the insulin hypothesis believe that sugar-rich beverages, as well as table sugar and refined starches, are driving dysfunction in our endocrine system, which controls metabolism and other crucial functions. These dietary carbohydrates, according to the insulin hypothesis, boost the body's insulin secretion, which redirects fat to be stored in fat cells rather than used up as energy. The thinking is that high consumption of products such as sugar-sweetened beverages, SSBs, lead to high levels of insulin, and that leads to high levels of fat being trapped in fat cells rather than being available for fuel for muscle and liver cells. The result is what some researchers call a state of internal starvation for those energy-deprived cells. The fuel is stored, so the body has fewer calories available to spend, but the need for that fuel remains, triggering hunger. A vicious cycle sets in. An individual eats more to satisfy that increased hunger, but the body hoards the fuel in fat cells instead of spending it, leading to fewer calories burned, but more hunger. The theory that a high-carb diet leads to higher insulin levels and more fat accumulation than a diet of equal calories but fewer carbs is testable. And Kevin Hall, senior investigator with the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases, tested it. The results, he says, didn't support the insulin hypothesis. Hall agrees that carbohydrates are metabolized differently compared with fats and proteins, but he says the difference is not significant enough to help with weight loss. If you compare extreme diets of, say, 80% versus 5% carbohydrates, it matters a little bit, he says. But when you compare the kinds of diets people actually eat, which fall somewhere in the middle of terms of carbs, it matters very little. In the real world, people have tried to lose weight with every possible ratio of fat, carbs, and protein, but no particular permutation has emerged as a clear winner across the board, which we would expect to see if the insulin hypothesis were correct. While some people lose weight by limiting carbs, others don't, and study after study comparing diets has reached the same conclusion. The best diet is the one that helps you limit calories. As long as you reduce energy by consuming fewer calories, you lose weight. If you could manipulate the macronutrient content of fats, carbs, and proteins to gain or lose weight significantly, we would have discovered it by now, says Alice Lichtenstein, a nutrition scientist and policy professor at Tufts Friedman School. The blame game. The simplest explanation for obesity, too many calories in and too few calories out, isn't as exciting or exotic as some of the unproven ideas out there, which may explain in part why it's so doggedly ignored. But there's another reason for its relative unpopularity. Researchers want to avoid blaming and shaming. Depending on how you frame that message, says Kevin Hall, senior investigator with the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases, it can read like we're accusing everyone of becoming gluttons. It should be about individual responsibility, you slothful fat person. That's certainly not Hall's message. Think of it more like this. Let's say you play Serena Williams at tennis. And you lose, because of course you lose. Is it because your tennis game isn't good enough? At some level, sure. But the real reason is that you're wildly overmatched, and you have no business being on the court with Serena Williams in the first place. If Rafael Nadal is reading this, my apologies. That's what's going on with the food environment. Corporations have entire divisions of highly trained staff whose job is to formulate food people can't resist. Food with supernormal appetite properties, in Hall's words. They are Serena Williams. You played varsity in high school. Maybe. Our moral failings, as many as they may be, didn't increase at the population level, says Hall. Obesity is the result of overeating, and a key part of it is navigating a food environment which, again, we're wildly overmatched. To be fair, the other causes of obesity currently under investigation are not figments of the researchers' imaginations. Yes, there is a difference in how your body processes a diet that's very high in refined carbohydrates. The microbiome does affect how your body absorbs calories. Some people are genetically predisposed to having a tougher time managing their weight. The issue, says Alice Lichtenstein, a nutrition science and policy professor at Tufts Friedman School, is the magnitude. These effects are real but small, and swamped by the simple equation no one really likes. Calories in greater than calories out equals weight gain. So, now what? Addressing the environmental factors that encourage overeating is an urgent priority, says Lichtenstein. We're eating in this environment that is stacked against us, she said. There's too much food. It's ubiquitous. It's cheap. And, to make it harder, all the social mores about where and when to eat have fallen by the wayside. We eat in the car. We eat in front of the TV. We eat at sporting events. Lichtenstein notes that her students regularly eat in class. We're eating everywhere, and we're eating bigger portions. Sodas are bigger. Burgers are bigger. Restaurant portions are bigger. Even the McDonald's Quarter Pounder, with the 4-ounce portion size right there in the name, got a boost to 4.25 ounces in 2015. New York University nutrition professor Marion Nestle believes those numbers tell the story. I think large portions are a sufficient explanation for weight gain, she says. Portion size, calories, and weight all went up in parallel from 1980 to 2000. Portion size is a particularly insidious problem for people trying to eat less, Hall says. Because most of us don't weigh our portions every day, you don't notice slightly larger portion sizes. You're going to start to creep upward, he says. And when the portions we see out in the world are uniformly large, we normalize that increase, adds Lichtenstein. Large portions are normal. High-calorie food is normal. Eating everywhere is normal. To fix obesity, we have to fix normal. And it won't be easy. But it won't even be possible unless we decide, collectively, that normal, not carbs, not fat, not insulin, not bacteria, is the problem. Life after war. A region in France, devastated by battle, undergoes an ecological makeover. The Battle of Verdun in northeastern France was one of the longest and bloodiest clashes of World War I, claiming roughly 300,000 lives. It also decimated the landscape. Intense artillery fire felled nearly all of the region's trees, and millions of exploding shells left deep depressions exposing the limestone bedrock. Now, 100 years after the end of World War I, recent research shows that new plants and animals have claimed the former battlefield as their habitat. They are adapting to the unique landforms of shell craters and underground shelters created by war. The German attack in February 1916 was designed to break the will of France and bleed her to death, in the words of Germany's chief of the general staff. The French were fiercely proud of the Verdun region and its massive forts, constructed after a humiliating loss to Germany in the Franco-Prussian War of 1870 through 1871. After 10 months of intense fighting, the destruction of the landscape was so complete that some pilots flying over said it resembled a moonscape. Human remains, unexploded shells, and rusted barbed wire littered the enormous battlefield, which encompassed 9 destroyed French villages, including Verdun. Lead and arsenic from bullets and bombs permeated the soil. After the war, the French government purchased the land and designated 23,000 acres as a zone rouge, red zone. This region was unsuitable for permanent settlement and too dangerous for regular public access. In addition, the memory of the war was too vivid to develop the land for another purpose. In the 1920s and 30s, to stave off erosion, government officials oversaw the planting of 36 million trees, mostly pine and spruce, in part of the Zone Rouge. These young trees, along with stands of older growth that survived the fighting, came to be called the Verdun Forest. The area was left largely alone for decades. Most of the visitors were hunters and war remembrance groups. Meanwhile, the vestiges of war began to be concealed by the returning flora and growth of the planted trees. In 2013, to prepare for the war's centenary, the French National Forests Office arranged an aerial survey of the Verdun Forest. During spring, a small plane flew low over the trees, equipped with a laser that emitted thousands of near-infrared pulses each second. By measuring the reflected light, scientists determined the precise elevation of billions of points on the forest floor. From these light detection and ranging, also called LIDAR, data, scientists mapped out not only the forest vegetation, but also the leftovers of battle: shell craters, trenches, bunkers, and underground shelter entrances. We have, down to centimeter resolution, a map of every single feature on the ground, says Joseph Huppe, a geographer at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, who studies the Verdun battlefield. The maps are so good that there's concern about them falling into the wrong hands. It's controversial to release these data because they might be used by grave robbers illegally looking for artifacts, Huppe says. Researchers have also used the LIDAR data to track the plants and animals that have recolonized or are newcomers to the forest. Depressions created by spent shells are a popular ecological niche. A few feet in diameter and depth, the depressions are often flooded by the region's heavy rainfall and shallow water table. A variety of plants, including rare orchids, and several species of newts and frogs have flourished in them. New species have arrived as well. Among them are yellow-bellied toads, which also inhabit the depressions, says Remy de Matos Machado, a geomorphologist at Université Paris Diderot in France. The toads, protected by the European Union, have a brown, warty back and a striking yellowish underside. Verdun is their northernmost habitat in Europe. New horsetails, ferns, and grasses grow near entrances to underground shelters, their roots curling around the structure's exterior stones. The shelters were dug by German and French soldiers as protection against enemy fire and the brutal winters of northeastern France. Bats hang from ceilings inside the cave-like shelters, though it's unclear if any of the 15 species are new to the region. The rough brick and stone interiors of the shelters are ideal for roosting. In other areas, American blue-eyed grass offers up an arresting display of color. Seeds of the grass were likely transported to Verdun by American soldiers fighting alongside the French. The Verdun Forest has multiple purposes. The French National Forests Office manages it as a timber source. Its staff plants seedlings and prunes trees. The forest is also the site of several memorials, including a cemetery with over 16,000 graves, and an ossuary filled with the remains of soldiers on both sides of the battle. And the ground itself is considered sacred, a final resting place for roughly 80,000 soldiers whose bodies were never recovered. The forest as well is a kind of wildlife sanctuary, where plants and animals thrive, both despite and because of the region's violent history. Since thousands of tourists visit the site each year, conservation efforts are underway to protect the landscape and the flora and fauna from human influence. Erosion is increasing and landforms are in danger, De Matos Machado says. The yellow-bellied toad and bat populations are monitored closely, and hiking trails now guide visitors around sensitive areas. The Verdun Forest's battle-scarred history, status as a memorial to fallen soldiers, and ecological rebirth combine to make it special, De Matos Machado says. There is no place like this. Twenty things you didn't know about big cats. 1. The first thing to know about big cats, there's no official definition of the term big cats. 2. In the 19th century, anatomist Richard Owen separated the family Felidae into roarers and purrers. Today, based on that distinction, some definitions consider cats big only if they roar. That's lions, tigers, jaguars, and leopards. 3. Owen thought that the different vocalizations stem from the anatomy of the hyoid, which supports the larynx and tongue. In purrers, this structure is rigid. In roarers, it's more flexible. 4. Asia's snow leopards defy that neat sorting, however. Despite having a flexible hyoid, the stealthy cats that locals call ghosts of the mountain don't roar. 5. Rescuers now think a pad of elastic tissue on the vocal folds, present only in roarers, explains the different vocalizations. 6. Other definitions group big cats by size and add clouded leopards, cheetahs, snow leopards, and cougars. The biggest of the big, the tiger, which can stretch up to 13 feet long. 7. Size advantages aside, tigers generally don't pose a threat to humans. The tigers of the brackish Sundarbans mangrove forest in Bangladesh are an exception, killing more than 20 people each year. 8. In the 1970s, a German biologist suggested that the tigers had liver and kidney damage from drinking salty water, making them irritable and prone to attacking humans. More recent research, however, points to high levels of human activity in tiger territory, setting the stage for deadly encounters. 9. In what's now Kenya, two lions infamously known as the man-eaters of Tsavo stalked, killed, and ate terrified railway workers in 1898. British officer John Pattison, who shot both animals, claimed they took 135 victims. 10. Modern analysis of the Tsavo lions' remains, now at Chicago's Field Museum, suggests the pair actually ate about 35 humans. Researchers determined the reduced body count from chemical ratios in the animals' tissues, which record dietary details. 11. A 2017 study of the Tsavo lions and a third man-eater from Zambia indicated that they may have turned to squishier, easy-to-chew human prey due to dental disease and injury. 12. Like many male lions in the Tsavo area, the man-eaters were maneless, a possible adaptation to the local climate, which is hotter and drier than the Serengeti. 13. In other regions, the darker the mane, the hotter the lion. And we're not talking about temps. Lions with darker manes have higher testosterone levels, signaling dominance and increasing their mating successes. 14. Another familiar color variant is the Black Panther, but, apologies to T'Challa, there is actually no such species. The term applies generically to any dark or melanistic big cats, usually jaguars or leopards. 15. The slinking, sinister Black Panther looms large across early American lore, stealing souls and stalking settlers. But besides occasional jaguars in the extreme southwest, melanistic big cats have never been documented in the U.S. Across the rest of the nation, the naturally tawny cougar is the only native big cat. 16. People may have feared cougars, yet it was the cougars that were in danger. bounty programs in the 19th and early 20th centuries drastically reduced their numbers across North America. Last seen in 1938, the eastern cougar was declared extinct in 2011. Cougars remained west of the Rockies, though, and documented sightings of solitary cougars in the Midwest have been on the rise in the last 25 years. 18. Re-establishing cougar numbers could reduce deer overpopulation. In 2016, researchers estimated that the big cat's presence would cut deer-related car crashes in the eastern U.S. by 22%. 19. Another potential reduction? Baby big cats. Most big cat males kill other males' cubs to send the mother back into estrus faster, so they can sire their own offspring. 20. Researchers have never observed a case of infanticide among cheetahs, however, possibly because cheetah moms get around. One study found that 43% of multiple cub litters contain cubs sired by different fathers, making it harder for a male to tell which cubs are his own, and thus less likely to kill. Who said cheetahs never prosper? 4 stories of building blocks. First, the great state of water. Looks like boring old water is more interesting than we thought. In a recent paper in Nature Physics, scientists describe a new state of the substance called superionic water. Here on Earth, we're used to seeing water in either its liquid form or as solid ice. Now it seems the life-supporting compound can exist as both a liquid and a solid simultaneously. Though not found naturally on our planet, superionic water could be present in extremely high-pressure environments, like those on the ice giants Uranus and Neptune. The discovery could help researchers better understand these frozen worlds. Second, hope for Huntington's. Huntington's disease, a genetic neurodegenerative disorder that leads to a buildup of toxic proteins in the brain, is fatal and currently incurable. But in a Frontiers in Neuroscience paper, experts explained how they've used a more precise version of the gene editing tool CRISPR-Cas9 on human DNA samples with the Huntington's mutation. Normally, CRISPR-Cas9 will snip out sections on both strands of a DNA's double helix. But in this case, the researchers used a variation that allowed them to alter only one DNA strand. After the edits, the mutated bits of the DNA were inactivated, and production of the toxic proteins shut down. Third, everything the light touches. Light's a fickle thing. Photons, the particles that make up light, usually don't like hanging out with other photons. It's why flashlight beams simply pass through each other. But experts have figured out a way to coax these particles to cozy up enough to form bonds like those we see from regular atoms. Researchers explain that these new interactions, detailed in a paper published in Science, could be useful in quantum computing and information storage, though we're still a long way off from those applications. Fourth, closing in on cancer. In a human trial of 55 patients from 4 months to 76 years old, roughly 75% responded positively to a new cancer drug. The trial, outlined in a New England Journal of Medicine study, examined the effects of larotrectinib, a drug that targets all sorts of cancers that evolve from a mutation in the gene responsible for creating tropomyosin receptor kinase, TRK. TRK is a family of protein receptors usually present in brain cells. Recently, oncologists realized TRK is involved in triggering tumor growth. The drug's promise is twofold. Larotrectinib, a TRK inhibitor, was engineered based on genetics rather than tumor type, and it's effective in patients within a wide age range. Bring back the dead, reviving ancient plants and viruses. Permafrost is cold, dark, oxygen-free, and has a neutral pH, that is neither acidic nor basic, like water. It's really the best place to keep alive something that doesn't need any kind of metabolic activity, says Jean-Michel Claveret, a microbiologist at Aix-Marseille University in France. That means microbes, seeds, and spores, frozen in a dormant state, could awaken with a little warming. This was proven in 2012 when researchers from the Russian Academy of Sciences sprouted 36 saline stenophylla, herby white tundra flowers, from 30,000-year-old fruits. The specimens were recovered from ancient squirrel burrows, 125 feet deep in the permafrost of northeast Russia, according to the study published in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. After sprouting in nutrient-rich test tubes, the seedlings had run-of-the-mill plant lives. They grew into fruit-bearing flowers in plastic pots and soil, resuming normal biological activity after being frozen for 300 centuries. Seeing the study, Claveret, who researches virus evolution, thought, if they were able to revive a plant, we should be able to revive a virus. Within 4 years, his team resurrected 2 never-before-seen viruses from the same 30,000-year-old deposits. Both reawakened in laboratory dishes and infected living amoebas. Through these experiments, researchers can directly study how viruses and life forms evolved over time. I think we can really try to understand better the origin of life, says Claveret. Permafrost is important because we can go deeper and find ancestors of those viruses. Currently, his team is preparing to analyze samples taken from more than 500 feet deep in the permafrost, dated to about 600,000 years ago. Although the scientists have only worked on amoeba-killing viruses, the research heightens concerns that pathogens infectious to humans will also emerge outside of the laboratory as permafrost thaws. This is already an issue in the Russian Arctic, where anthrax outbreaks in the early 20th century killed an estimated 1.5 million reindeer. Many of these animals, along with infected cattle, are buried in near-surface permafrost, the so-called active layer that thaws in summer and freezes in winter. When warmed, the carcasses release anthrax spores, which readily reactivate into infectious bacteria. The phenomenon likely caused a 2016 outbreak that hospitalized 72 Nenets reindeer herders. And it's not just anthrax from rotting reindeer. Cemeteries across permafrost zones of North America and Russia contain victims of smallpox, plague, and influenza. However, Claveret believes there is low risk of a global pandemic from these diseases in permafrost. If it's an old, known disease like smallpox, it will be sad for the poor people who get it, but it could be okay because it could be recognized quite easily and you put the people in quarantine. He is more concerned about unknown diseases deeper in the permafrost being brought suddenly to the surface by mining and industrial development in the Arctic. Prehistoric pathogens for which we have no known defense. Frozen heritage. Archaeological sites found and lost. Permafrost thaw is opening other windows to the past at archaeological sites. It's this incredible archive of information, says Jeff Rasick, chief of resources for Gates of the Arctic National Park in Alaska, who works at Diggs in Arctic Alaska. Things that should have rotted away a long time ago have been frozen and preserved. Perishable items like basketry, wooden tools, and clothing can be preserved for millennia in permafrost and show how ancient peoples survived one of the toughest environments on Earth. For example, at Burnirk, a site in far northern Alaska dated to AD 600 to 1300, archaeologists recovered parkas, boots, and even baby clothes made from seal skins and polar bear fur. Incredibly high-performing garments out of all natural materials, says Rasick. They made fine needles and threads and could sew watertight seams in a time before Gore-Tex and all the high-tech fibers we have now. At another Alaskan site, Raven Bluff, bones were so well preserved that Rasik assumed they were a few hundred years old. But results from radiocarbon dating brought a shock. Raven Bluff was inhabited 11,000 years ago. Permafrost sites of this era are key to understanding how Ice Age people migrated from Siberia and settled the Americas. Permafrost thaw may help archaeologists discover sites because the warming ground leads to erosion, which exposes artifacts. But it's a double-edged sword. Unless the sites are quickly excavated, the perishable artifacts rot away, and there are not enough Arctic archaeologists to keep pace with the thaw. We're resigned to always losing more sites than we can ever address or save, but there's a real pressure right now to be very efficient with our triage decisions, Rasik says. It's a matter of collecting information before it disappears. Permafrost thaw isn't the only threat. Melting ice sheets bring additional risks. Last summer, climatologist William Colgan, a researcher for the Geological Survey of Denmark and Greenland, led an expedition of scientists to Camp Century, an abandoned U.S. military base buried in the Greenland ice sheet. When you get to Camp Century today, it's totally flat white. There's nothing showing above the surface. It's just a pancake, white, ice sheet, says Colgan. But 10 stories beneath the surface are the remains of the facility, which in the 1960s spanned more than 100 football fields and housed as many as 200 soldiers from the U.S. Army. One mission was top secret and codenamed Project Ice Worm. Install ballistic missiles under the ice sheet, within range of Russia. By 1967, the Army had abandoned the project, leaving behind hazardous wastes, including sewage, radioactive coolant, and carcinogenic industrial chemicals, as well as diesel fuel. Engineers at the time assumed these toxins would be preserved indefinitely under the ice. But the Greenland ice sheet is melting, and faster than once projected. From 2007 to 2011, the ice sheet shrunk by about 290 billion tons per year. Compare that with an average loss of 83 billion tons per year from 1900 to 1983. According to Colgan, the good news is that if countries meet goals laid out in the Paris Agreement and other climate change fighting guidelines, the site should stay frozen. The bad news? If current warming trends continue unabated, the toxic wastes will likely begin to melt out of the ice sheet irreversibly within 75 years. To make these predictions, the authors estimated the extent of debris using historical records and maps from the camp. The goal of the 2017 expedition was to set up long-term monitoring of the site. The scientists couldn't physically enter Camp Century because decades of snow and ice accumulation have sealed the entrance. It doesn't look like there's any airspace left in the tunnel network, so even if we were to dig down to 30 meters to one of the access points, it looks like all the tunnels are just crushed completely shut, Colgan says. Instead, the researchers collected ice cores for analysis and installed weather and ice monitoring devices, which transmit real-time data back to lab headquarters in Copenhagen. Donning cross-country skis, they also towed ice-penetrating radar across the surface to produce more accurate maps of subterranean debris. The radar data showed that waste is spread across about a mile, double the area expected, and in some spots is at a depth of less than 100 feet. Despite the extensive spread, Colgan believes the waste could remain trapped in ice. Whether or not Camp Century becomes a problem has very much to do with our choice of climate pathway as a society, he says. That wraps up this episode of Discover Extra Edition. I hope you've enjoyed it and will tune in to another podcast soon. Until then, expand your mind. I'm Steve Lord, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. If you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138.